Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 65, Clinical Applications of Positive Psychology, December 7, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
A young woman that I worked with had an eating disorder. And as many women with eating disorders do, she thought about being attractive and being thin as pretty much her whole sense of identity. So she was awfully cute, but that was the only thing she focused on. So each week when she came in, I might have her tell me one positive thing about yourself that does not have to do with being cute. And what strengths of yours did you draw on that enabled you to do that thing? And all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, over a number of months, I guess, this person went from being kind of a two-dimensional person to being very three-dimensional. I learned a lot more about her and her talents and skills. She learned a lot more about herself in doing that, too, and came to value some of those other aspects of herself as well.
That was the voice of my guest, Judy Salzberg, Ph.D., a licensed clinical psychologist who practices from a cognitive behavioral perspective. A founding fellow of the Academy of Cognitive Therapy, she supervises therapists in training and has taught seminars in the University of Pennsylvania Resiliency Program. She's interested in the application of positive psychology to clinical interventions. Here's the interview. Dr. Judy Salzberg, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We recently had Dr. James Pawelski on our program talking about positive psychology, and he mentioned your name as someone who is a clinical psychologist who's both taught a course on positive psychology and who's also applying it in clinical practice. So let me start out by asking how you got interested in positive psychology in the first place.
Well, you know, I think I've always been interested in positive psychology. I just didn't know it was called that.
Right.
I was trained in cognitive therapy back in the late 80s, early 90s, and I liked the adaptive approach and looking for ways to deal with difficult situations and not just trying to understand why. And then positive psychology really kind of put a name to what I was trying to do all along and given me a lot more options of how to do it more systematically.
Okay. Now, you say you took your degree in cognitive therapy. Where was that?
I did my undergrad at Penn, and Marty Seligman was my advisor, which was great. We did a neat study on, I would now call it resilience in life insurance sales agents. And then I did my PhD at Stony Brook, which was real behavioral. And then I came back to Penn and studied with Beck for a postdoc in cognitive therapy.
Oh, so you really got to study with some of the biggies in the field.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great place to be.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about cognitive behavioral therapy, because we haven't had a guest on speaking about that. So maybe just kind of give our listeners a quick thumbnail sketch of that approach, and then we'll focus more on positive psychology.
Okay, in general, I would say cognitive therapy works on the premise that the way you think affects both the way you feel and then what you do, and that if we can identify patterns of thinking that are getting you in trouble and come up with some kind of alternative way to frame or think about a situation, we might also be able to help you find different ways to behave or cope and also hopefully feel better too.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how that position has evolved, because I'm old enough to remember the sort of earlier days of behaviorism when behaviorists really didn't want to talk about thinking because it couldn't be directly observed.
Right. Even at Stony Brook when I was there, there was a group of professors who were more interested in observable behavior than cognitive processes as well.
Right.
But I think that's been helpful. It's helpful to have that perspective, because in therapy, as in research, as in anything else in psychology, you want to know if what you're doing is helpful, and so you need to know what you're trying to change and how you would know if you changed it. So if it's an observable behavior, sometimes that can really be a big help.
Yeah. So you studied with Marty Seligman, who's the founder of positive psychology, while you were an undergraduate, right?
Right, right. And at that time, he was teaching abnormal psychology, as it's called, which is all about disorders, you know, kind of a catalog of disorders.
Yeah.
And he was a wonderful professor, and he was good at it, but I take it from hearing his perspective these days that he kind of grew weary of always focusing on the negative side of things and the dark side of things and wanted to talk more about human flourishing.
Okay, so then how did you find out about positive psychology, which I guess he, quotes, invented sometime after you had graduated from Penn?
Right. Well, I had always stayed in touch with him and have done some projects with him on resilience training. Mm-hmm. There's some really interesting work we did with Penn undergraduates where we were trying to identify those freshmen who were at risk of being depressed but weren't yet depressed and trying to sort of inoculate them, if you will, with some skills. And then they followed them up for about 8 or 10 years to see whether indeed having that kind of inoculation kept them from getting depressed later. So I was in touch with him about those kinds of things, and that was kind of a bridge, I think, between cognitive therapy, because a lot of the skills we taught were cognitive, to this whole idea of resilience and then positive psychology. So we've just kind of stayed in touch.
Okay, and then later he started a kind of a coaching program in positive psychology. Did you enroll in that?
Yes, I did, and it was... I don't know if you've heard about the program, but it had these, what do they call them, these group calls, master calls they called them, where they'd have Marty and all kinds of different lecturers talk on a bridge line, and you could listen from your phone. Mm-hmm. And then they had what were called pods, which were discussion groups of about 10 to 15 people. And mine was led by Karen Rivich, who's written a book called The Resilience Factor.
Right.
And so she and I have worked together on some of these resilience workshops, so it was great to have her as the leader.
Okay, yes, I was on the email distribution list for Authentic Happiness, so that's how I was aware of it, but I didn't sign up for the course, so it'd be interesting to hear your insider's view of what that was like.
As a clinician, it was really great because the person who would speak would present their corner of the world in positive psychology, complete with data and research findings, and then in the applied part, in this pod call, we could talk about how each of us would apply it in the kinds of work that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a real opportunity to be creative with the material and think about who would benefit from hearing more about it. And we had people on the call like Chris Peterson, who was talking about strengths and virtues. And we had Shelley Gable, who talked about active constructive responding. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
And Barry Schwartz, I believe, was on talking about how to make decision-making a little bit less onerous on people. So these were all really useful concepts when I, you know, got back to work on Monday. So
right. Now, you have taught and I guess will be teaching a course on positive psychology. Where do you teach that class?
That is in the program that James Pawelski described. It's the Masters of Applied Positive Psychology at University of Pennsylvania. So it's a really eclectic group of students. It's really a fascinating place to teach.
Okay, now is this an undergraduate class or a graduate course?
It's a graduate class, so they're master's level people, and they all have some kind of degree. And I would say about a third of them are fresh out of college, and they're interested in going on in psychology, and they want to kind of get a grounding in positive psychology. And then the rest of them are out in their respective fields working and doing the degree at the same time during the year. So it's really an intensive year for them.
That sounds pretty challenging, having that much diversity in the classroom of people who are relative novices and others who are already professionals.
It is really challenging, and the professionals are in really diverse fields as well. There's, you know, always a core of students who are coaches, you know, professional life-type coaches, not sports coaches.
Mm-hmm.
But this year we have an orthodontist.
Wow.
We had a comedian last year.
Great.
Who else have we had that's been kind of interesting? We had some human resource people, a guy who was in charge of a large construction company. There's some people interested in education. There was a guy who's high up in administration at a private boarding school. So you know, what we tried to do to make it a little bit less challenging was group the students into what we call cohorts.
Yeah.
Where there's kind of small learning groups of about three or four students, and tried to group them so that they would have some common interests.
Okay.
When they did their projects together.
Yeah. You're mentioning the comedian. Reminds me, there's a woman who I'm trying to remember her name, Loretta something, who she really has a whole stand-up routine, a lot of it based on Marty's work.
Really?
Yeah.
I would love to hear that.
Okay, well, I will, after this call, I'll look up that information and I'll send it to you. I'm really sorry that it's not at the tip of my tongue here, but I purchased one of her videos and actually used it in a class that I was teaching on human potential.
Uh-huh.
And you might find it useful in your own class. So,
thank you.
How many students typically would be in the course?
The course that I taught last year was just people who were more interested in clinical applications.
Yeah.
So we had a nice small group. I believe there were about 12.
Okay.
So we could really discuss things. This year we restructured the course a little bit, so we combined Karen Rivich's course on coaching applications mm-hmm. with mine on clinical applications, and everybody will take it. So it'll be a little different.
And that'll make it about how large?
About 35
okay,
students.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then how often will it meet, and how long are the meetings?
It's this really interesting executive model, they call it, mm-hmm. where students come for 5 weekends per semester. So they're either mm-hmm. 2 or 3 day weekends,
okay.
and they're in class from morning till night.
Yeah.
So that's really intensive. And then they go back to their respective parts of the world and professions and so forth and have a distance learning period in between where they post papers and discuss different things that way and do some assignments that way.
So would your class be that whole weekend, or would your class sort of be one of a number that they would take during these intensives?
It would be only a portion of it. It would be somewhere between 4 and 6 hours each weekend.
Okay. Okay.
And so that way they get some variety each weekend as well.
Yeah. As somebody who's done a lot of teaching, I'm interested in all these sort of nuts and bolts issues. So I don't know if my listeners will be or not.
So there's a thing called eCollege, which is an internet setup that kind of houses all of this.
Okay.
So their assignments are posted there, and I can do all the grading of papers there and give it back to them there. So it's almost paperless, the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's your course objective? What is it, bottom line, that you hope students will get out of the class?
Well, since some of the students were novices, I wanted them to get at least a brief taste of what the field of clinical psychology is like from what we call a business-as-usual perspective.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what do people do in their consulting rooms without adding positive psychology in? And I tried to talk a little bit about what kinds of treatments are already empirically supported, and to also talk about the medical model and what it buys us and what's bad about it as well. And then tried to teach them a whole group of interventions from a book by Michael Frisch that I found very useful.
What's the title of that book?
His book is called Quality of Life Therapy.
Okay. And how do you spell his name?
It's Frisch.
Mm-hmm.
He covers a whole spectrum of positive interventions. And the thing that's so great about it as a clinician is he's put a lot of worksheets and exercises for the client on a CD-ROM.
Mm.
And all the documents are in Word format, so you're allowed to download them, customize them, print them out, and use them as you see fit. So that's been tremendously useful.
Oh, that's great, because I know in my own teaching I've always been interested in making classes as experiential as possible.
Mm-hmm,
and I noticed that in some of Marty Seligman's materials that he also generated some experiential sorts of assignments.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you about that in terms of your own course, if there are experiential components and what some of the more interesting assignments have been.
Well, one of the first assignments was to have them take the signature strengths inventory, which is something that Chris Peterson and Marty created, where you identify your top 5 strengths.
Yes.
And the students had already done that way at the beginning of the program, and that's kind of woven throughout. But I asked them to think about those 5 strengths and how would those strengths help them as a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And would any of those strengths, if they took them to an extreme, start to have diminishing returns. So that was one kind of experiential exercise, was thinking about that and writing about that.
Oh, can you give an example of, I don't know if you'll be able to remember, but, you know, what might be five strengths that a person would have and how those would be helpful in therapy and how, if taken too far, it would not be helpful?
I'll kind of put a composite person together, but
sure.
Somebody might have the strength of curiosity mm-hmm. and kindness and generosity. And if we just take those two for a second, the curiosity would be a great thing as a clinician because you want to be interested in what people are coming in and telling you about.
Right.
And the kindness and generosity as well, it would certainly be a real strength to be kind and to be generous with your time and things like that. But some of these folks were way at the beginning of their careers, and I wanted to make sure they didn't take that generosity to an extreme and possibly even get into boundary violations with clients, giving too much time, being too available, those kinds of things, that they were still able to stay within the structure of therapy and understand why that's in place. So that's just an example of something that might go to an extreme and not be so helpful for them.
Yes. Curiosity is a good one. When I was in therapy, that was one of the things that struck me about the woman that was working with me, was that she was so curious about every...
It's genuinely so,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, about every detail of my life. And, of course, we all want to be listened to, and her curiosity did seem so genuine that it made me mm-hmm. feel very important.
Yeah, it's a great thing to have as a therapist. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. So what kinds of feedback have you heard from students who've taken this class?
They had a lot of fun. They really enjoyed another experiential exercise they did was they took a couple of the Frisch exercises from his book and applied them to themselves.
Okay.
And so they were able to really try these things out and see what was good about them and perhaps some limitations of them and that sort of thing. So I think they really had a good time in the class.
Yeah.
And they were very interesting discussions, and they were particularly interested in hearing clinical material because a lot of them had not yet become therapists.
Right.
So that was another one of my goals, was to instill a positive psychology perspective right from the start, so that as they went through their training, they would have in their mind to also be aware of people's strengths and what kinds of positive institutions and so forth were in these people's lives, so that they could bring those to bear as well. So the course got great feedback, and the book got great feedback as well. So,
what are some examples of the exercises that they were doing from the Frisch book?
One simple exercise is something he calls the playlist, and it really has its roots way back in the behavioral therapies, like with Lewinson and pleasant event schedules and things like that. But he put together a list of about 400 things that are fun to do.
Yeah.
And you might give that to a patient, I use those interchangeably, patient, client, whatever, who is having trouble having fun in their life.
Okay.
And give them some ideas of things they might be able to tap into that would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Either things they maybe used to do as a kid and have sort of forgotten about, or trying new things. And I've used that with a number of people, but you know, certainly people who've had a horrible childhood and not had time to really play.
Yes.
It can be a real nice balance to some of the serious work they have to do as well.
Okay. I guess it can serve a dual function. One is reminding someone of good times that they've had in the past and kind of revivifying those feelings,
mm-hmm.
as well as perhaps suggesting new areas to explore to bring more fun into their lives.
Right, right. Exactly.
Okay. Is there another exercise in the book that comes to mind?
Yes, there's one. Well, there's certain sort of standard cognitive therapy exercises in there as well. There's one he calls the lie detector inventory or something like that, which is pretty much based on what cognitive therapists would call a dysfunctional thought record, where you try and identify what kind of situation triggered some negative thinking, what the thinking was,
yes,
and what the consequences of that were, and then try to think about different ways to frame a situation.
Okay, in other words, the lies we tell ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The sort of self-defeating untruths that we tend to feed on.
Exactly, right, and especially ones that are habitual patterns that cross lots of different scenarios in our lives. Those
yeah.
are particularly important to look at. there might be, let me just think, there's another exercise I liked a lot. He has a nice goal-setting exercise where he talks about 16 areas of life that one might look to promote greater happiness. Mm-hmm. And they might be things like love, relationships, family, living situation, financial, and has people go through each of those areas and think about how they can apply their strengths to improve those areas.
Okay.
The idea is it's not only important to take the areas that aren't going well and fix them, but areas that are already not bad, to strengthen them as well could bring greater happiness. So
yeah.
I really like the way the 16 areas are laid out that way, because sometimes there's areas that people hadn't thought about improving.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about your course. Let's talk about your therapeutic work. How does positive psychology inform your work as a therapist?
Well, I think, you know, there's certain positive psychologists. There's one in particular named Tayyab Rashid who has done empirical work on applying positive psychology to people with depression.
Okay.
And he had a fairly structured program. I think there were about 12 to 14 sessions where he would talk about different aspects of positive psychology, like using strengths and three pathways to happiness and different kinds of things like that. I tend to weave it more into the cognitive therapy that I'm already doing.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, it's kind of an umbrella that I'm looking all the time for, okay, what's already going well that can be amplified for this person, and how can they use their strengths in a different way? What areas of their life, the three pathways to happiness are the meaningful life, the pleasurable life, and the engaged life.
Interesting. I've not heard that breakdown before.
Yeah, the pleasurable life is sort of the way most people might think of positive, you know, pleasurable things, sensory delights, eating, things like that. The meaningful life is connecting with something larger than yourself. So it might be connecting with other people or something spiritual. And then the engaged life has to do with helping people get into what we call a state of flow.
Yes.
And so helping people take a look at their lives and see if anything is out of balance regarding those three pathways to happiness.
Okay.
So some people might have not enough pleasurable life, and so somebody like that might do well to take that playlist and think about adding more pleasures into their life. But some people, like I worked with somebody who was doing too much meaningful life, if you will. I mean, she was always doing things for other people and spending all her time doing that, and probably needed to unplug from that to some extent to do things that were more in a state of flow or just were pleasurable in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to weave those things in. And also when we think about what the goals of therapy are, that's another important area where positive psychology has an influence, that Marty Seligman will often talk about. The goal isn't to get from -6 back up to 0 or neutral. Our goal might be to get to +4 or relatively happy. So I think it has to do with where's the end point as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of those overarching ways that I apply the positive psychology in practice. And then there might be very specific exercises and things like that that we'd apply depending on what the issue is that they bring.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. A young woman that I worked with had an eating disorder, and as many women with eating disorders do, she thought about being attractive and being thin as pretty much her whole sense of identity.
Yes.
So she was awfully cute, but that was the only thing she focused on. So each week when she came in, I might have her tell me one positive thing about yourself that does not have to do with being cute.
Uh-huh.
And what strengths of yours did you draw on that enabled you to do that thing? And all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, over a number of months, I guess, this person went from being kind of a two-dimensional person to being very three-dimensional. I learned a lot more about her and her talents and skills,
mm-hmm.
and she learned a lot more about herself in doing that, too, and came to value some of those other aspects of herself as well.
Was it initially hard for her to identify these things?
Very hard, very hard. We'd have to go through day by day. Tell me about Monday. Tell me about Tuesday, you know, and I'd have to sometimes prompt things in areas that I knew she might be strong. You know, for example, she was real nice with kids. So I might say, did you see any little kids this week? You know, was there any example in that area? So, yes, it was very difficult, and now it's gotten a lot easier.
Uh-huh. Great, great.
Yeah, so that was a fun example. That was very rewarding to see her take that own perspective of herself, take that positive perspective on herself.
Right. Now, do you think positive psychology applies to all clinical conditions?
I would say yes. I don't, because positive psychology also thinks about institutions and positive institutions and thinking about community-based kinds of things that might be helpful for people, including churches or groups or things like that. And I think even people with really severe pathology can benefit from being part of something bigger than themselves. Mm-hmm. But I would say that I'm very careful about the timing of some of these things, that if somebody comes in a lot of distress, I'm not going to all of a sudden start talking about, well, okay, that's well and good. Tell me about three good things in your life. Tell me three blessings.
Yeah.
Because I feel like until you've heard all the sadness and anger and everything else, sometimes they're not quite ready to focus on the blessings and may feel kind of invalidated if you don't hear the other things first.
Right.
So I think the timing is really tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And now, sort of is something that can't be manualized.
Yeah, yeah. This is kind of a new area still, I think, and I'm wondering if are there any groups that are beginning to coalesce of clinicians, of psychotherapists who are interested in positive psychology, in other words, a particular focus on psychotherapy and positive psychology emerging as a field within psychotherapy?
That is a really good question. I know that there's this International Summit of Positive Psychology that takes place in the fall in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And there was certainly a core group of people there who were very interested in this. And in fact, Mike Frisch and I gave a talk together on some of these issues, mm-hmm. and the room was overflowing. We ended up having to go to another room and give it again because there was so
wow.
much interest.
Yeah.
It just, you know, in the topic. I don't think it was us per se, but the topic in particular that people were really, really interested in. So I think that's one place that we may see some of this coming together.
Mm-hmm.
I also think a number of cognitive therapists are interested in these kinds of things too. And there's a group called the Academy of Cognitive Therapy.
Okay.
That was started by, I say the Becks, Tim Beck and his daughter Judy Beck. That's a credentialing organization for cognitive therapists. And they have a very active listserv, and a lot of people on that listserv seem to be interested in these kinds of things as well.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe something will emerge from there.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the cognitive group, but do you think positive psychology could be integrated into other therapeutic approaches? For example, psychoanalytic, Jungian, Gestalt?
That's an excellent question, and I was trying as I was creating the course to get some speakers in from those perspectives.
Yes.
And I almost had an analyst in, and he wasn't able to come, but apparently there are certain analysts who are interested in sort of positive defenses and the benefit of using certain defenses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there are some analysts that way. There's definitely some existential folks, I think more over in London. There's a guy named Alex Linley, who has written a bit about that. He's got a book called Positive Psychology in Practice that he edited and wrote a couple chapters for.
Okay, that's a good tip. I'll try to follow up on that. Positive Psychology in Practice?
In Practice?
In Practice, okay.
Yeah, that was out in 2004.
Okay, yeah.
It's a good volume. It's an edited book, you know.
Okay. Yeah, certainly it seems to me that this sort of basic stance could be incorporated into other approaches. It's not something I've given a lot of thought to, but just at first blush, I would think so.
I would think so, too.
Yeah, where do you think a positive psychology needs to go in the future? Is there research or training that you think is needed to make it continue to advance or to be more widely adopted?
Absolutely. Think that we as a field need to come up with some more empirical studies of what we're doing, because I think any good psychotherapy kind of has to be empirically validated. And Tayyab Rashid did the first one, and I hope there will be other studies like that. Because even though I'm in a private practice, so I may not do a full manualized treatment like that, it's important to know that the concepts have been validated by somebody who has.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a major direction that we need to go.
Okay. Now, you're trained as a therapist, and I am too, so we're both really interested in the nitty-gritty of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask you a personal question.
Okay.
Has positive psychology helped you at all in your own personal life? And if so, how so?
It's a question because it sort of just feels like it's who I've always been. I just didn't know the name of it. I tend to be somebody who looks for, I don't want to just say looks for the bright side, but looks for the positive in a situation, who looks for what can somebody do. You know, I one subspecialty I have is I work with people who've got chronic illnesses, and so I'm always looking for what kinds of adaptive things can we come up with so that they can function at their best.
Yes.
So I think it's just been very validating to have the whole field, which echoes kind of the way I normally have conducted myself. So I'm not sure it's caused a major change. I do have to say that the people who are in the positive psychology program, in my experience, tend to be very positive people. So I'm sure there's some people who are there because they want to become more positive. But in general, it's such an energizing weekend to be around these people because they are really positive through and through. So I'm curious who the field attracts, but it seems like it attracts some pretty energetic, upbeat people.
Okay. Well, as we wrap things up, do you have any last thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with?
There is Marty's website is available. It's called AuthenticHappiness.com, I believe.
Yes.
And it's a free website. The bargain is that you're allowed to take a number of well-validated research inventories for free and get feedback on them. And in return, you agree to let them use your data just in a normative kind of way.
Right.
They would never use your individual data. But the strengths inventory is on there. It's called the VIA Strengths Inventory.
Right.
VIA meaning values in action, and it will help you identify your top five strengths. And then a really easy way to start applying some of this is to think about, well, how could I use those strengths in different situations in my life? It's also kind of fun to have a significant other person do it and see how your strengths interact together.
Mm-hmm.
There's an exercise we do called a strengths date, where you have to come up with a date that helps, that uses your top couple of strengths as well as your partner's. So that's a fun way to start, is to go and do that inventory. It's fairly lengthy, but it's worth the time investment. And get that data for yourself and see how you might want to apply it.
What about having your special other evaluate your strengths as well? I'm just wondering if self-identified strengths match up with strengths that somebody who knows you well identifies you as having.
That is a really good question. I don't know if they've done that in the clinical realm, if they've tested that out. I know that in the business world, where some of our students come from, they have something called a 360 evaluation, 360 degrees.
Yes, I've heard of that.
And that means having you self-rate as well as having your direct reports rate you and your bosses and so forth rate you. So in that sense, I guess they're doing that. They're ahead of the game there.
Yeah.
But I have not heard of that in a clinical setting. It would be interesting.
Yeah. Well, Judy Salzberg, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It was fun to think about these things.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Judy Salzberg. You may have noticed that I spent a lot of time asking about the positive psychology course she teaches. I hope this part wasn't too drawn out for you. I must confess I had self-interest at heart, inasmuch as I have submitted a proposal to Sonoma State University's Lifelong Learning Institute to teach an 8-week course on positive psychology. So perhaps you can forgive my eagerness to pick Dr. Salzberg's brain for good ideas to apply to my own course, should it come about. I think this is a hot topic in psychology right now, and should have some appeal to our lifelong learners. Unfortunately, most of the books that Dr. Salzberg mentioned are quite expensive, in my opinion. I think this is because they're being marketed as textbooks. Those of you listeners who are college students or parents of college students will be aware of how the price of textbooks have skyrocketed out of sight in recent years. I have difficulty adjusting to the idea of paying $100 or more for textbooks. I've even seen college texts that cost $300. The books Dr. Salzberg mentioned tend to be in the $50 to $100 range, which hardly recommends them to the casual explorer. As you heard, Dr. Salzberg practices a cognitive behavioral approach to psychotherapy.
I think that as positive psychology continues to ripen, we will see it begin to impact other theoretical perspectives as well. I'll be keeping my ear to the ground, and you can expect that I will be interviewing other positive psychology practitioners as time goes on. I've been reading a wonderful book by one of our upcoming guests. The book is titled The Heroic Client, and I highly recommend it to you all. One of the co-authors is Dr. Scott D. Miller, who I'm very much looking forward to interviewing. The book is a passionate diatribe against the medical model, the use of mental health diagnostic categories, and over-reliance on psychiatric drugs. The author's arguments are supported throughout by extensive research citations, and while they don't fly under the explicit banner of positive psychology, the approach they advocate is certainly congruent with it. They say the evidence supports the idea that psychotherapy is indeed effective and beneficial, but most of that benefit comes from two factors: the strengths the client brings and the relationship. The school of therapy that the therapist subscribes to makes surprisingly little contribution to therapeutic success. The key thing is that client is king, and the therapist needs to do everything possible to build a collaborative relationship and to listen for and amplify the client's strengths and own recuperative powers. I wholeheartedly believe in this myself. Stay tuned for the interview with Scott Miller, who will be able to make these points with even greater force and clarity.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Jeff Smith. We're happy to be sponsored by Podshow and GoDaddy. Use the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout, and you can buy a domain name for a whole year at GoDaddy.com for just $6.95 instead of the usual $8.95. Christmas is coming up, and buying a vanity domain name for friends or family can make for a unique and surprising gift. And speaking of Christmas gifts, you can now purchase the first 50 Shrink Wrap radio shows on two MP3 CDs. The first has shows 1 to 25, and the second shows 26 through 50. These CDs are $12 each, or $20 for the two of them. And you can get them at www.poddisc.com. That's PODDISC.com. And you'll also find a link to the site on the left side of the page at shrinkwrapradio.com. Not all of your friends and family get this podcasting thing. They find it too confusing, too hard to download, too hard to figure out. But you can give them 25 shows on a CD, and all they have to do is pop it into their computer or into an MP3-compatible CD player. Thanks again to all who've taken our listener survey. We're creeping up ever so slowly. We're now at 89 completed surveys, and I'm still hoping to drive that number to 100 or more in the next couple of weeks. I believe our listeners number in the thousands, so I really need to hear from you. I need to hear from you. If you haven't filled it out yet, please do so. You'll find it at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And there's a link on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And for everyone who completes the survey and includes their name and email address, I'm going to send you a link to a radio talk on dreams I gave before a live audience at the University of New Hampshire. We've got two new additions to our Frapper map. I want to give a big thank you and welcome to John in Virginia Beach and Tortugo 23 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. To add yourself to our Frapper map, all you have to do is go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book I co-authored on the infamous Zodiac serial killer, for which a major Hollywood motion picture is about to come out very soon.
Have I been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio, or is it really all in my mind?
Is that Vincent Price, or is it David Bond in Manila? Thanks, David, for using my Chingo to record that great transition. Now let's catch up on our listener emails. And as luck would have it, our first email is from David in Manila, who writes, "Hi, David. You know, I have to admit that it's so cool getting mail from a celebrity. I was the same when I worked as a producer and writer at the BBC. I just love to be around the famous folk. It was some sort of energetic thing, I think, the draw of charisma. Anyway, I'm psyched to get mail from the preeminent pod psych. Hey, thanks so much. I'm getting my 15 minutes of Andy Warhol-type fame here. All you need is a microphone." He goes on to write, "So-called pop psychology is a wonderful phenomenon, isn't it? So many millions are touched by it in some form or another." You know, actually, that's an interesting comment, because I think we tend to be so dismissive of, quotes, pop psychology. But you're right. Much of it is actually written by psychologists, and the general public at large, I think, benefits quite a bit from a lot of it. So it's a good point that you make, and one that I haven't really stopped to reflect on before. Who knows? I might write a pop psych book at some point myself. Now, David goes on to say, "Actually, I hadn't heard of your guest before." He's referring to Randy Gage. "I expect, though, given the circles I find myself in, his name would have come up sooner rather than later. David and I have been having some correspondence, and he's in network marketing. We've been talking about a product that he's espousing." And so David goes on to write, "I've been surprised and impressed by the general levels of consciousness I've experienced within the network marketing / direct sales community. There's a pervasive and wonderful conversation for growth and contribution that I've not experienced in other domains, certainly not during my time in TV. Vaya con Dios, dear doctor." Well, thanks so much for that message, Dave. And I look forward to talking to you more and discussing the direct marketing ideas some more. Now we hear from Ken Valerio, another frequent contributor, who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, I was working in my studio recently on a Saturday, and my wife was on the couch reading. So I took the opportunity to push your podcast on her by playing it through the radio. When she heard you read my email, she was very impressed with me. So thanks for that. My sex appeal went up a few notches." Hey, we're all about enhancing sex appeal here. "Your second show was wonderful." Here he's referring to the second show on money and wealth with Jesse O'Neill. He goes on to say, "It's a great idea having a couple of theme-based shows. I liked how you also challenged this guest. My conclusion is that money is never a good starting point for action. I'm more of a lilies of the field kind of person. Do the right thing and you'll be provided for. All my best, Dr. Dave, and keep banging out the hits. Ken." Next, we hear from Douglas in New Mexico, who writes, "Dr. Dave, thank you so much for your podcast series. I will write more about myself soon. Right now, I'm busy with finals. I'm a returning student at 35 years. Well, thanks so much for taking time from your studies to write, and also thanks for the plug that you gave us in your blog. And finally, we hear from Lloyd in Australia, another longtime listener and frequent contributor, and he writes to say that he finds positive psychology actually to be somewhat irritating. He says, "Hi again. I have a bit of a negative reaction to positive psychology. I have always had a predilection for the darker side of existence, and I find words like happiness slightly repulsive. Guess I come from the Nietzsche school of thought, where contentment is seen as a kind of death of soul. I also believe that throwing yourself into suffering is the key to self-discovery. Perhaps also Buddha taught that life is suffering, so trying to find happiness in this reality is misdirected and ultimately futile. So all this adds up to me viewing positive psychology with a kind of scorn. I shouldn't, because the above is only going to work as a philosophy for a very small number of people, and for the rest it probably could be very helpful. In regards to reading things on air, I leave those decisions up to you. I had asked whether I had permission to read some of his negative observations on positive psychology. So he's telling me, yes, it's okay. He says, I have no problem with you reading anything I write to you, so you always have my permission. Thanks for your thoughts and always for your great show, Lloyd. Hey, Lloyd, I appreciate this input. I think it's a valuable corrective. You know, as a Jungian, I always have to believe in the dark side. Jung says it's only the wounded healer who heals. And so I guess I'm holding the paradox of being Jungian, of believing in the importance of the shadow and the inevitability of the shadow, and at the same time having some hope for a more positive approach to psychology. This is a paradox I will continue to hold. And I think that better wrap it up for our email today. Now, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is Shrinkpod. Alternatively, you're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo, and you'll have a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. And if you're in the U.S., you can leave a voicemail on our phone. And the phone number has changed because not enough people used it. If it doesn't get used in 30 days, then the phone number expires. So the new phone number is 206-337-0622. Use it so it doesn't expire. Or, in other words, use it or I lose it. Thanks again to Dr. Judy Salzberg for the interview. And I want to let you know that our next show will be about sports psychology and peak performance. My guest will be Sonoma State University professor Dr. Glenn Brassington. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.